Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last Thursday, the Federal Reserve released a report on the economic well-being of U.S. households. Among the findings, sobering statistics on retirement. 40% of people over the age of 45 have postponed their retirement plans, and one in five between 55 and 64 have no money saved for retirement at all. That report sparked a lot of discussion in the news, online, and among the Word of Mouth team, which represents a demographic span from young invincible summer intern Molly Donahue to late millennial producer Taylor Quimby and senior producer Maureen McMurray representing Gen Y. Me, let's just say I'm old enough to worry about how I'll support myself later in life. We sat down together to talk about how, or even if, we think about retirement. First of all, tell us how old you are.
I'm 21.
Okay. Is retirement even a thought, a conversation, an inkling in what you're thinking now as a woman going into your senior year in college?
You know, not really. I actually don't ever really imagine myself past age 40. And I have no plan. Like, I don't even understand what a 401k is.
It's embarrassing to admit because I don't want to tell you like when I discovered this wasn't the case. But for a very, very long time, I thought 401k stood for $401,000, which is how much you needed to retire. Like, you needed to have exactly $401,000. And then you'd be okay. Like, you have enough to retire and live comfortably for the rest of your life.
I know I have one now, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that I've had one in the past, but I haven't done Jack. I have no idea what's even in there. So
have you done, you know, like, you're married, any kind of financial plan or anything like that that you and your husband are sharing or working towards or anything?
It's unfortunate that I kind of do this stereotypical thing where the man handles the finances. Mm-hmm. I know I've done something, but I feel like we just started and I'm 35 mm-hmm. now.
It was just before you guys came in doing a sort of calculation of how much money I have to save. Or what is it called? It's called a plan your retirement calculation. So the result says it appears that your current savings will only provide enough income to age 69.
Oh.
To provide you.
Is that only 4 years of retirement?
Do you have any expectations at all of a social safety net provided to you by the federal government when you're in your old age?
No.
Not really, no.
No. I mean, maybe if I work for the government.
I guess I just don't like to think about it. It causes a lot of anxiety. I'm very nervous and anxious talking about it right now.
Then do not by any means use this calculator. Aging is not what it used to be. For many people, the image of retirement was once packing everything into an RV and driving across the country, visiting national parks and tourist attractions, and experiencing the freedom of the open road. Today, pensions are rare, and foreclosures have wiped out equity and delayed dreams of leisure for legions of Americans. Journalist Jessica Bruder has been exploring the rising number of people who have adapted by hitting the open road to chase low-wage jobs across the country. These geriatric migrants ride a circuit of seasonal jobs, picking fruit or selling Christmas trees, stocking warehouse shelves, taking tickets at Dollywood, struggling to stay one expensive car repair or injury ahead of tragedy. Jessica wrote about what happens when you can't afford to stop working in an article called The End of Retirement for Harper's Magazine. Jessica Bruder, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, give us a sense of the numbers of aging Americans who are working beyond traditional retirement and how those expectations have changed.
Well, there are lots of them, and the growth is pretty staggering. Nearly 7.7 million Americans, 65 and older, were still working last year. That's up 60% from a decade earlier. And we're still in an era where you've got almost three quarters, 71% of Americans who are pre-retirees, that's 50 to 65, they envision retirement as a time of leisure. But only 17% of those people expect that they won't work at all in later years. That's according to a survey from AARP.
Yeah. And you met several people who call themselves these work campers, travelers, nomads, picking up mostly seasonal work. One of them, Linda May. How did she end up on the road?
Linda May was living in New River, Arizona, in a trailer, working as a Home Depot cashier. She's a pretty formidable woman. She's been everything from an insurance executive to working in construction to being a cocktail waitress. Worked hard all her life, but like many Americans, never had a job that brought her any kind of lasting security. So she doesn't obviously have a pension, and pretty much realized that she was going to be trapped rattling around that trailer and working as a Home Depot cashier. She realized that she was going to be working that job to pay the rent for the rest of her life with no retirement in sight. And she thought that was rather silly. So she ended up saving, putting all the money she could put together into an RV that was a little beat up. It had just run into a telephone pole. But Linda's, you know, she's crafty. She can fix it. So she decided to go out on the road. She'd heard about people who were living on just $500 a month, which is what she realized she'd be getting in Social Security. So she figured she would have more working flexibility if she were living on the road.
And Linda, like many others, found work at an Amazon warehouse in Fernley, Nevada. And it's one of several facilities that Amazon is actively recruiting these RV dwellers into what it calls its Amazon Camper Force. So what's the appeal for Amazon?
It's counterintuitive at first because these jobs at Amazon are very, very physical. You're standing on a concrete floor for, you know, 10 hours with a couple of little breaks, but it's not easy. You're lifting, you're squatting, you're stooping, you're going upstairs. I did meet people who'd been injured. So you wouldn't think they'd want older people, but the thing with older people is they show up and they keep showing up. I've listened to several online seminars, talked to a former Camper Force recruiter, and what I hear said over and over again, both on the employer and the employee end, is that this is a generation of people with a real work ethic, with pride. They're not strutting around saying, I'm too good for this kind of work. And at the same token, they just keep showing up. They do it.
And you mentioned what a tough, physically demanding job it is. How does Amazon handle injuries or caring for older workers?
Several folks told me that Amazon, several people who'd been working in the warehouses, told me that Amazon has these on-site facilities called AmCare. So that's the equivalent of a first aid, first responder station. For serious injuries, they need to be taken out by ambulance. A lot of people are also just, you know, hitting the over-the-counter pain relievers as much as they can. Several workers also told me that those are made available free of charge in the warehouses.
Peak time for the Amazon warehouses is around Christmas time. Think about the conditions of living in the cold. You know, where do they park? Tell us a little bit about what life is like when they're not in the Amazon warehouse or other jobs.
Well, basically, when they are parked, so if they're working at Amazon, there's a big cluster of RV parks stretching as far as Reno, where they park. And it gets pretty cold. And Fernley, I was there in October, and you know, not that long after I left, there was snow on the ground. So people are wrapping heat tape around their pipes. Their water's freezing. I talked about a lot of folks have pets. They're buying electric heaters because they don't want to run the propane when they're gone to keep their pets warm. It's not an easy way to live in the wintertime.
We're speaking with journalist Jessica Bruder. She dove into this subculture now being lived by a number of people of retirement age. They're crisscrossing the country in RVs and campers, chasing seasonal jobs. They're sometimes called the Okies of the Great Recession. People call them work campers and migrants. Those riding on the economy's outermost edge. The article she wrote for Harper's is called The End of Retirement. And talk to us a little bit about this sort of concept of retirement. You dig into the history and the reversal that it suffered of late. Can you summarize that for us?
Absolutely. So retirement is a relatively new invention in the U.S. For most of the history of humankind, people worked until they died or were too infirm to work, at which point they tended not to stick around for very long anyway. The idea of it actually began in Germany, where the statesman Otto von Bismarck came up with the concept in 1883. The idea was that everyone who was unemployed over 65 would get a pension. This was actually to fend off Marxist agitation at the time, and not many Germans made it to that age way back then. In the U.S., obviously, the New Deal is what brought us Social Security. In the Great Depression, we had so many workers and not enough jobs, so part of the initial idea of retirement was to clear out space in the workforce for the younger generation while also giving older people a well-deserved break if they'd worked all their lives. So that's where it came from. But if you think of other reforms, retirement has become a bit controversial, but some things like, you know, the weekend, for example, mm-hmm. we're not ready to give up. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me that it's become such a third rail in politics.
The reason it is such a big discussion in politics is because of the huge amount of entitlements that have to be paid in the future. But one of the things that you write about is that people of 65 and older are more dependent on Social Security than any other source, which was really surprising to me.
Absolutely. And this is something that isn't just a handout. It's something, you know, you pay into Social Security all your life. And if you're in a higher wage job, you get more Social Security. And if you're in a lower wage job, you get less. So it's not, I feel like there's a lot of talk as if it's a handout. And I definitely don't think it is. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, around the time of the New Deal, this was never supposed to support people completely in retirement. It was supposed to be a supplement that would complement your existing pension. Now, pensions have ceded to 401ks, which has been a failed experiment, if you ask me. And at the same time, we assume that people would have savings and investments. But for a lot of people today, people were cleaned out by the Great Recession. Not everybody, but a lot of people.
And like Linda, had no pension. She had worked most of her life in low-wage jobs, a blue-collar worker for the most part. But you met many others, a former academic advisor, a former cowboy, a former radio producer, which, you know, was chilling to me, and Chuck Stout, who for 45 years was an executive with the McDonald's Corporation. Now, how did he end up in an RV?
Sure. For Chuck, for some of those years, he owned and ran a franchise, but for a couple of those years in the 70s, he was actually the head of product development for McDonald's Global, which is
huge.
Kind
job.
Of blew my mind. Yeah, as his wife likes to chime in, Chuck is the reason they have ice cream. And then Chuck always says, oh, honey, it was my team. It was my team. But yeah, I mean, Chuck worked hard. He made some bad investments that didn't pan out. His nest egg, he had around $200,000 that got wiped in the recession, and it was enough to push him out. He and his wife declared bankruptcy. They had a small house, but it was a house on a golf course. They lost that. They lost the car. They ended up buying an RV for, I believe, $500 off of Barb's brother because he didn't need it anymore. That's Chuck's wife's brother. And they took off on the road. And, you know, Chuck is 70, and he was doing the picker job in the warehouse, which is, by all accounts, the hardest job. It's the most active one.
Well, at the end of the season, many of the RV dwellers head to Quartzsite, Arizona, which somebody calls the Burning Man for geezers, and find camaraderie. They swap stories. They swap hints. What are some of the kinds of transient survival tips that get shared there?
Well, I was lucky in that I got to sit in on some really amazing skill shares and seminars at the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, which is organized each year by a fellow named Bob Wells. They were talking about how you can go to Los Algodones, Mexico to get cheap dental care, how to do stealth parking so people don't harass you when you're sleeping in your car in a place that is otherwise public, how to cook with fire, how to patch a flat, how to install solar panels on your RV, how to talk to your family about what you're doing. I mean, it was really a pretty fascinating community, and watching them collaborate to make it work for themselves was pretty cool, actually.
Well, this seasonal work is working out right now for people like Linda May and Chuck Stout and others. But what about when they are 75, 85? Is there a strategy in sight for the folks that you spoke with?
Some of them are doing their best to get through the day and trying not to think about it. I mean, I definitely started worrying. I mean, I liked these people, frankly. I came to worry about them. So I started asking. Linda May, because of her construction experience, she's planning to go in on a patch of land with her daughter and try to build this marvel of 70s passive sustainable architecture called an Earthship. There's somebody else who I talked to who said, let me die on the road. The scary thing is, when I talked to tons of people, I actually did hear about a couple people who had died on the road living in RVs parked far from family. There are people who, as folks have for generations, will fall back on their children. A lot of people don't like doing that. They don't want to strain younger families, and they want their autonomy, but sometimes they don't have a choice.
Well, Jessica Bruder, thank you for your story and filling us in today.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Bruder wrote about the rising number of retirement-aged Americans who work low-wage seasonal jobs across the country. Her article is called The End of Retirement, and it was for Harper's Magazine, which is available on newsstands. Coming up, forget the stars of Hollywood, London's music scene, the fashion of Milan, and the bright lights of Tokyo. South Korea is aiming to become the world's chief exporter of cool. We'll get that story after the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Who hasn't seen at least a clip of the video for Gangnam Style?
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
It is an easy dance to mimic. The video has horses, fake snow, dancing girls, and the enigmatic Psy in wingtips and a blue tux. Gangnam Style was the first video to rack up a billion hits on YouTube and part of the calculated strategy of Hallyu, or the influence and export of South Korean pop culture onto the global landscape. Korean movies, K-pop music acts, games, and TV shows in particular are proliferating throughout the global South and could be Korea's gateway to becoming an international superpower, even by American standards. Yuni Hong is author of The Birth of Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. Yuni Hong, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. I'm happy to be here.
South Korea, just 50 years ago, you describe as having a GDP lower than Ghana and even North Korea. Now it's the 15th largest economy in the world. How did it come from so far behind so quickly?
Yes, well, basically a lot of developing countries currently are trying to figure out this very thing. The short answer is that Korea is what I describe as the only capitalist liberal democracy on earth that runs like a command economy. What do I mean by that? I
yes.
mean that since the very beginning, the government and its private industry have worked closely in cooperation on basically every major decision in order to advance the economy. And this has extended even to the current somewhat crazy-sounding project of making Korea the world's top exporter of popular culture.
Well, what you describe in the book is this strategy very much by design, a government-led initiative to do no less than dominate developing world markets in pop culture. How? Can you bring us through the strategy?
Yes. I would say, first of all, to preface this, I think everyone, including Korea, realizes that they are not going to replace the United States as the main exporter of pop culture, but they are probably going to replace its monopoly on world pop culture. And what I mean by that is that Korea is going after markets that the United States does not really care about, either because they're too poor, like Paraguay or Zimbabwe, or because they consider America to be a harbinger of sin, like the part of the world that's been taken over by Islamist fundamentalism. A lot of American programming that used to be popular in places like Iran, maybe in the 60s or 70s, is now either outright illegal or can only be shown after midnight. And Korea makes these dramas, by contrast, that are very chaste. There's usually no kissing until episode 10. And this is a perfect fit for the Arab market. And in fact, in Iran, there's a show that has taken 80% of viewership, which is called My Love from Another Star. It's actually one of the most famous Korean dramas worldwide. It's about an alien from outer space who came to Korea in the 17th century. And in the 21st century, he falls in love with an actress, and if they kiss in episode 10, but he almost dies. And so it's very much this old-fashioned, almost Jane Austen throwback. And this works really, really well in a lot of world markets.
Mm-hmm. 나한테 15초만 줘봐. 무슨 15초?
내 별명이 15초의 요정이야. 15초짜리 광고만으로 사람들을 확 다 사로잡거든.
Can you describe Korean diplomats actually smuggling tapes of television programs to Hong Kong, for example? The Korean government paying to have shows dubbed into Spanish? It's so interesting given the huge strides that Korea's made in technology and business and education that making a choice of Korean pop culture, where does that stack up in the priorities for Korea as a country?
Right now, it's the number one priority, actually. It's wow. The government's stated policy.
So can we draw a line directly from government ministry? In fact, there was a ministry created for this purposes to PSY, for example.
PSY is a very strange instance of the exception proving the rule. On the one hand, nobody in Korea, I should say, was surprised that it was a Korean video that got a billion hits on YouTube. However, everyone was surprised that it was this particular artist. And I say that because PSY is considered an outlier. He did not go through the K-pop factory system. He writes his own songs, which is extremely unusual. He has the wrong look. He's a little too old. And he makes fun of things that Korea thinks are kind of sacred. And so it was very much an in spite of thing. The Korean entertainment industry was grooming the more attractive conventional bands like Girls' Generation and Big Bang. PSY came out of nowhere. I don't think even he knows why he was the shot heard around the world.
Yeah, and K-pop, I guess, to just describe those bands further, sort of boy bands, you know, some of them under multi-year, 12-year development contracts to groom these kind of stars for the system. This strategy would be impossible without the concept of Han, if I'm saying that properly.
Yes.
Han is what you introduce us to as driving the country. Now, what does that mean to you? What is Han?
Han is a culturally specific form of anger, vengeance, wrath that can make you so upset that you could actually literally die from it. And this is a disease that appears in the DSM manual, which is the Bible for the Psychiatric Institute. It's like dying of a broken heart, except you're dying of of unfulfilled vengeance. And by definition, only Korean people can have it. I like to describe it as the opposite of karma, because whereas karma can be worked off from one lifetime to the other, Han actually only accumulates. So you inherit the rage of millennia of the generations from the minute that you're born. This has a lot to do with influencing the Korean work ethic, their drive, their desire to beat Japan in the economic wars was a huge motivator because they're ancient rivals. And it's one of the most enduring and mysterious mutual animosities in the modern world, actually. And I don't know if this is true in general, but for Korea, their wrath actually keeps them alive. It's what they live for, which makes them stronger. And in fact, Ian Fleming in his James Bond series said, Koreans are the cruelest race, as a way of explaining why he had Odd Job as his manservant.
Well, which would make a lot of people roll their eyes, but you said reading it as a kid felt somehow vindicated, like they got it right.
No, exactly. I was just wondering, wow, did he spend time in Korea? How did he know that? Because that was something that I really observed, is that I've never seen so many random fistfights between, you know, people, you know, dressed in nice three-piece suits, you know, where it's considered socially acceptable to just have enemies. And where nobody, you know, will just tell you to let things go.
We're talking about the South Korean soul, I guess, and also its strategy for global domination through pop culture, from kimchi to Gangnam Style. What it's doing and how it's working is the subject of Yoon Hee-hong's book, The Birth of Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. For the book, you spoke to Lee Moon-won, one of Korea's most influential pop critics. He tells you that Koreans are not good at creativity. This is maybe a stereotype we've heard before. Koreans don't innovate, they copy. So why have filmmakers like Park Chan-wook and musicians like PSY, for example, been able to cross over?
Yes, I would say that of all of the pop culture exports, film is the one that is the least profitable. For precisely the reasons that you mentioned, they're highly artistic, which is why the French love Korean film. they're also violent and they lack the chastity that it described in the Korean dramas. And it's basically sort of the one area where if you're genuinely creative and not that commercially oriented, you will probably enter film. I think that Koreans are very philosophical and creative. But I think the point that the culture critic was trying to make is that what the secret behind Korean success in pop culture is that they're extremely good at packaging. So, for example, your average K-pop song, the song itself will have been usually it comes from Sweden. The studios buy Swedish songs by the thousands. The choreography might be done by an American. And it's all just sort of assembled, but the assembly itself does require creativity. So I would, in that sense, qualify the culture critic statement. The way that it's packaged is very plug-and-play. In the case of literal packaging, one of the reasons Korean music does so well is that they're actually making CDs that can cost $150 because they come with all these bells and whistles. And that's why they've conquered the Japanese market even more than American music has, because for some reason, Japan really buys a lot of CDs. It goes against the trend of the rest of the world. Mm. So it's sort of an obvious marriage of demand and supply.
It's not just in Asia and South America that Hallyu is working. It's also penetrating the markets in France, for example. Why is it that it's not hitting it big in America?
So I think the dirty secret of the Korean wave is that they kind of don't really care if they get the American market, because in the state the world is in now, you can actually do really, really well without capturing the American market. They're not the only ones with money anymore.
Yuni Hong, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Okay. Thank you, Virginia. It's a pleasure.
Yuni Hong, author of The Birth of South Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. While the Korean wave has yet to crash onto American shores with any significant volume, a few Korean films and filmmakers have landed cult or art house successes here. We previously spoke to Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr about the film Snowpiercer by director Bong Joon-ho. Snowpiercer had a very limited release in American theaters, but is now doing gangbusters on demand. After our conversation with Yuni Hong, we went back to Ty and asked him about other South Korean films that have been adapted for Western audiences in recent years.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Korean film is sort of in a similar position that a Japanese genre film was in about 10, 12 years ago, when Japanese movies like Ringu were getting remade as American horror movies, Ring. And in fact, Hollywood has a history of looking overseas, finding interesting creative stuff, and then dumbing it down for American audiences. Mm. The difference is, you know, the change in availability of these films, and you can pretty much get anything you want to get your hands on thanks to the internet. Snowpiercer, which is directed by Bong Joon-ho, is only the latest of his very wonderful movies. So yeah, you can see Bong Joon-ho's earlier movies. I mean, The Host got a pretty big release in the United States, and that is a wonderful monster movie, sort of like a tongue-in-cheek Godzilla with a sort of gonzo creative side of its own. But one of his early movies, called Memories of Murder, did get an art house release in this country, but very few people have seen it. And it's a fascinating movie, kind of like David Fincher's Zodiac. It's about the police trying to catch a serial killer. Hmm. Park Chan-wook is probably the other most well-known Korean director in this country, especially with his Vengeance trilogy, Lady Vengeance, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and Old Boy, which was just remade by Spike Lee. Unnecessarily, but, you know, nice try.
South Korea has a pretty vibrant film industry, at least domestically. What do you think is behind that?
Like a number of other countries in the Pacific Rim, I think there's a real cross-fertilization in the many different aspects of their popular culture. So you've got, you know, comics and manga, and, you know, the manga-like comics feeding into genre filmmaking and whatever's going on in TV and whatever's going on the internet and in music. You've just got a lot of young energy taking, you know, traditional American genres and ideas and taking them for a spin around the block and pulling them apart and putting them together in unusual ways. There's just a sort of freedom of movement between genres. One of the things I like about the new Korean filmmakers is that the films look like they're in a certain genre, but once you see the movies, they leap all over the fence. They go whichever way they want to.
What would you say characterizes or ties together the films that are coming out of South Korea?
Well, it's easy to say that there's a lot of interest in the more violent genres, suspense, action, horror, and that definitely is an aspect. But you do get some remarkable dramas and some – there's an aspect of romance there, but that hasn't played out in a lot of Korean film. I'm thinking of movies like Poetry by Lee Chang-dong, which is about an older woman taking poetry classes and dealing with tragedies in her life. Again, it sounds like typical art house fare, but it takes a couple of turns that make it feel really unusually fresh and incredibly moving at the end. Kim Kai-duk, who is a director who specializes in pretty outrageous genre fare, where his movies can get pretty graphic, made this absolutely gorgeous Buddhist movie, I mean, for lack of a better word, called Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring, which was an art house hit here back, I think, in 2005.
I remember that one.
Yeah. It's very different from the movies he usually makes, but that's another instance of how you really can't pigeonhole a lot of these directors of the movies that they're making. I mean, it's when we're used to movies that really follow a set path, certainly the commercial multiplex movies in this country, and even the so-called independent films. You know, you go to a Woody Allen or a Wes Anderson movie, or certainly a Transformers movie, and you know how it's going to go. These movies, you don't know where they're going to go. You start at one point, and who knows where you'll end up.
Do you think they, just because of the language barrier, they'll ever be able to really transcend to the multiplex? I mean, Snowpiercer crossed over because it's made in English.
Snowpiercer crossed over because it's made in English and it has a box office star and still wasn't allowed to fully cross over. It's doing very, very well in on demand. But no, I mean, any movies with subtitles and not recognizable English language stars are not going to really take off in this country. The few exceptions I can think of are like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which, I mean, that was a fluke, and that was how long ago?
Mm-hmm.
So the Korean films are probably going to be cult favorites and sort of delights to an inside audience, which doesn't mean that outside audiences should go find them. And again, these are so much easier to find now. I would love to tell your listeners to go dig up The Host, Bong Joon-ho's The Host, or Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring, or Poetry, or Old Boy, if they have the nerves of steel. Even something like a movie like Kim Jo-woon's The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. Not a great movie. It kind of goes over the top early and often, but it's a lot of fun, and it shows a director just sort of letting his imagination run free. I'd love more people to see these movies.
Well, we'll have a full list of those suggestions on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Ty, thanks so much for filling us in. Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe and author of Gods Like Us on Movies, Stardom, and Modern Fame. A link to more on the book as well at wordofmouthradio.org. Design is an integral part of filmmaking and, as it turns out, also an important part of televised sporting events. The sound of sport and why you may not want to believe everything you hear when Word of Mouth continues. When it comes to watching televised sports, sound is a crucial part of the experience. If you'd like to put it to the test, next time you watch a game, try turning the sound off. But still, bringing life to televised sports through sound is more difficult than you might imagine, and often goes far beyond setting up a mic near the action. This story comes to us from Roman Mars podcast 99% Invisible, and was produced by Peregrine Andrews.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. If Dennis Baxter and Bill Whiston are doing their job right, you probably don't notice that they're doing their job. but they are so good at doing their job, you probably don't even know that their job exists at all. They are sound designers for televised sporting events. Their job is to draw the audience into the action and make sports sound as exciting as possible. And that doesn't mean that they throw a bunch of microphones on the field. This is Dennis Baxter, sound designer of the Olympics.
There's some sports that you just cannot capture the natural sound. Cross-country skiing, biathlon is another one. Because of the size of the course. And this has been further complicated because as the camera lenses have gone up 110, 120, 130, 140 to 1, these cameras are able to see a half a kilometer, maybe even a kilometer down the course. Now, how do you replicate that sound? Essentially, if you got cameras that are that far apart from each other, you're putting 20 or 30 microphones to fill as the athletes are coming to you, which is not practical. I am not a purist whatsoever in sound production. I truly believe that whatever the tool takes to deliver a high-quality, entertaining soundscape, it's all fair game. And that has caused some issues because I use samplers. What a sampler is, it's a keyboard that's attached to essentially a digital recorder. When you hit the key on the keyboard, it triggers the sound to play back, and with the keyboard it also triggers with sensitivity, meaning that if I hit the key real hard, it'll have a little bit more of a harder attack, and you can vary the pitch. If I hit a C note that has a sample, and then I hit a D note of the same sample, it will be up a step. So for the skiing, it gives a shh, shh.
Redgrave and Pinson still hold the lead. The French in third, and we could do without seeing them at the moment.
In Atlanta, one of my biggest problems was rowing. Rowing is a 2-kilometer course. They have 4 chase boats following the rowers, and they have a helicopter. Okay, that's what they need to deliver the visual coverage of it. Okay, but the helicopter and the chase boat just completely wash out the sound. So no matter how good the microphones are, you cannot capture, you cannot reach and isolate sound like you do visually. But people have expectations. Okay, if you see the rowers, they have a sound that they're expecting. So what do we do? That afternoon, we went out on a canoe with a couple of rowers and recorded stereo samples of the different type of effects that would be somewhat typical of an event. And then we loaded those recordings into a sampler and played them back to cover the shots of the boats.
And the Australians have bitten something back from them, but not enough. Great Britain, gold medals! Stephen Redgrave, Matthew Pinson, mission accomplished.
Stand by. And they're racing. Good even dispatch, although...
When we do our horse racing, you're not going to get somebody running around the course after the horses. There's no way. And occasionally you will come across very close-up pictures of the horses over the far side, which is done off one of our roving cameras. But you have engine noise in that case, so therefore you wouldn't want a microphone on that, because all you would hear is the car revving up and the cameraman cursing. So, basically, the way you cover all that sort of stuff is to run a tape which has the sound of horses' hooves galloping, which is actually, if I remember rightly, a slowed-down buffalo charge. That's pretty much a standard thing, and I think it's probably the same recording they've used for years.
That story from Roman Mars podcast 99% Invisible and produced by Peregrine Andrews for Falling Tree Productions. It's an extract from a much longer and really stunning documentary called The Sound of Sport. You'll find the full documentary on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Maybe there was a time when children liked clowns, but now not so much. There was that well-publicized 2008 study from England that found that most kids between 4 and 16 dislike and even fear images of clowns. Maybe you're among the many adults who find them creepy, too. Earlier this year, the New York Daily News reported that the U.S. is in grave danger of a clown shortage. Membership at the World Clown Association is down, and as older clowns retire, fewer young ones are stepping into their oversized shoes. Meanwhile, Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus reports intense competition for clowning jobs. So what's the truth? Lee Cowart traveled to a clowning convention to find out for herself. Her article, Don't Be Afraid of the Clowns, appeared in BuzzFeed. And Lee, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello.
So how much truth is there to this declaration of a clown crisis?
Well, it's a yes and no. When you think about circus clowns, it is kind of a dwindling art form in that there aren't younger people signing up in the same numbers that there used to be. However, clowning is a lot bigger than just the circus. So when you talk about clowning, are we talking about circus clowns? Or are we talking about this very human and necessary way that we cope with things that are hard?
Well, where do those non-circus clowns find work?
Well, it helps to think about clowning as the opposite of stand-up. So compare Jon Stewart would be a stand-up comedian, and Stephen Colbert on his show is a clown. Because for Stephen Colbert, the joke is on him, and for Jon Stewart, the joke is, what am I observing? So the act of clowning is this very physical thing that invites the audience to laugh at themselves through the person that's performing.
But we think of clown, and we think of white face paint, big red noses, funny wigs.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that tradition of clowning come from?
Well, the American idea of the clown is very rooted in Ringling Brothers. The circus coming to town was a very big part of American entertainment, and that image is so iconic. So for Americans, it's this childlike entertainment. It's very big and fun and kind of scary up close. But for many other cultures, the clown is more of a political symbol.
Open that up for us a little bit, that's kind of the clown archetype. What are its origins?
So ancient clowns, or clowns from more primitive cultures, tended to be religious figures or medical figures. So they were very much an integral part of teaching the community the right way to act by demonstrating the wrong way to act. And also they could lampoon areas of tension and conflict with impunity. That is, they could make fun and it was protected because nobody wants to get into a fight with a clown. And so the ability of the clown to poke us in our softest, most vulnerable spots and make us laugh and not hurt is really important to just the survival and the enjoyment of daily life.
That is a sort of societal role that clowns used to play before in the, as you put it, you know, before Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus kind of days. But now people are really polarized about their feelings about clowns. Why do you think that is?
I think that's completely normal, and I don't think that's anything new. Jaron Aviv Hollander, a clown that I interviewed from Oakland, he said that Stephen King didn't make clowns scary. when he wrote Pennywise the Clown, he found something that was inherently scary, and he wrote about it.
And this was a character in his novel It, which was later made to a film.
Indeed. The first thing about clowns being scary is the makeup. And I like to refer to it as all caps face, because it was designed so that the people in the very, very back of these huge tents could have something to see and read on the performers in front. And you think about the way that these circus tents were lit, and it was candles, and they really needed huge eyes, huge mouth, a lot of contrast. And up close, it is the visual equivalent of being screamed at. Today, we interact with our entertainment at a very intimate level. You know, we have a tablet near our face. We look at our cell phones. And so if you, you know, get a text message and you look at your phone and it's a picture of a clown face right there, of course that's going to be scary. You're literally being screamed at with the makeup. So that's the first part of it. The other side of things is that there is an inherent disconnect. If you see someone with a painted-on smile and they're not smiling, then you already know they're lying to you. And people who are lying, like, that is going to make you uncomfortable. And then they're lying to you by pretending to be happy. And there's something really unsettling about really innocent intentions. Like, if all they want to do is make you happy, and yet you're sensing that there is conflict within them based on makeup versus expression or their dedication to the bit or whatever, that's going to be uneasy for you. And that's a reasonable thing to recoil from.
But at the same time, when you told people that you were going to the conference, your friends expressed concern for your well-being. What's behind that? And were you at all nervous?
I was nervous. And it makes sense when you realize that clown makeup is a mask. And when someone's wearing a mask, there's an inherent level of discomfort there because you can't be sure that what you're seeing is real and that you can trust it and that you can trust them. Aside from that, there is something really unsettling about pressing the elevator doors and three clowns are just standing there. But at the same time, the great irony is that these people, like everyone I spoke to, was so dedicated to fighting that. They really wanted people to not be scared of them. And it almost seemed like if they could just say, you know what, this can be scary, and here's why, and let's work on it. The clowns that were able to do that tended to have more success at things like birthday parties, whereas the ones who didn't want to acknowledge that they could be scary tended to be more likely to, say, overstep a boundary.
You referred a little bit earlier to this idea of clowns mirroring who we are, you know, like comedians mirroring who we are, or reflecting some parts of ourselves that we may not always want to acknowledge. So what do you think, after confronting your own anxieties about clowns at this conference, where do you come away? I mean, are they still serving some sort of essential role in society, or, you know, are they going the way of the buggy whip?
I think clowns will always be essential in some capacity. Now, we may be looking at a change. You know, there's a new generation of clowns. Circus arts are coming back in a big way in the United States. So will there be a clown in 100 years? I think yes. Will it look like the clown today? Maybe not. But it will be absolutely necessary because they give us permission to laugh at ourselves and to laugh at all the things that are horrible or that we are scared of, all of the things that make us human and messy, and all of those little idiosyncrasies that we like to hide because we're not supposed to show them. And the clown says everybody else has them too, and it's so ridiculous, and maybe it's okay to laugh at that.
Well, the clowns that you spoke to mostly regard the clown shortage as a myth, but are they getting work? Doing what?
You know, at the convention, the joke was that there was no shortage because if there were fewer clowns, they'd be getting more jobs. And the feeling was very much competition for them hasn't changed. They're not feeling like, oh, clowns are retiring and I'm getting more work. In fact, most of them were like, this is just the media doing what they do. They really, it was completely disregarded. I don't think anybody took it seriously.
Well, Lee, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Lee Coward is a freelance journalist. Her work has appeared in The Independent, Vice, Deadspin, among other places. Her latest piece, Don't Be Afraid of the Clowns, was on BuzzFeed. And you'll find a link to look at her article as well as some vivid images from the convention she attended at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Me here at last on the ground, you in midair.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Lee's been thinking and writing a lot about why we seek out laughter and what distinguishes clowns and comics. She told us why she thinks Jon Stewart falls on the side of comic, for example, while Stephen Colbert is more clown. Another comedian who often walked the line between comic and clown was Robin Williams, who died last week. Here's what Lee had to say about him.
He was perhaps the most iconic American clown. He made it okay for people for generations to laugh at themselves through him. He was never afraid to make his pain alleviate some of the ache of our own.
You can find a full version of Lee's thoughts on Robin Williams as iconic American clown. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. You get the full spectrum of human emotions here on Word of Mouth. Please join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.